Check, 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 check. Do, 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 do. I started Gag Me With a Spoon because I really love to, I love to hear people's personal stories. I think we're more fascinating than fiction, and I really like the community building aspect of, in a small town like Duluth, Minnesota, where you think you know everybody, you don't know everybody, and you get to know people on a little deeper level and share vulnerability and grow as a community in the day and age of Facebook. I think it's a connecting thing to share our stories and something we've been doing throughout history. So I'm trying to kind of bring that into my life and hopefully share that with others.
Your hair looks really good.
So thank you for being here. Miriam, I saw you. Oh, you're wearing sequins. It's sequin night.
Thank you, Adeline, so much. I'm so honored to be able to be up here again. I've shared a lot of stories here, and I'm also just grateful to have stories to share. This story starts when, in October of 2018, I went to Nepal, and I was visiting a Tibetan Buddhist friend who'd been living there about 8 or 9 years. And I flew into Kathmandu, and she'd arranged for me to, over the next 2 days, to take 2 flights and a bus ride to go way up into the mountains where there's a Muktinath temple. This is a very famous and holy place way in the tippy top of the Himalayas. And I was to be a witness and sit with her in a Tibetan Buddhist temple where they were chanting for 8 days straight. The monks would arrive at 4 in the morning and chant until 6 at night. And they had these beautiful plush seats for us to sit upon, cross-legged, and a big heavy cloak that was all velvety that we draped over ourselves to stay warm. We're in the Himalayas after all. And we were witnessing them chanting prayers for the release of suffering of the in the world. And it was quite a sight to behold. And they would read from their little books nonstop, chanting nonstop. And, you know, the cliff notes of those prayers, those 8 days of prayers, are basically, may all beings be happy and free, and may my actions, deeds, thoughts, and words in some way contribute to the happiness and freedom of all. So this is all happening over these 8 days. I was there for, like, the last half. And their chants are going into Tsokni Rinpoche, who is a reincarnated Rinpoche, who is receiving these vibrations and these chants, and through the purity of his being, they are being filtered into this little thread. It's a poly cotton, multicolored thread that is attached to his golden throne, and then it leads to this incredible sand mandala that's behind this wall. That's a very, 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 very detailed, enormous sand mandala that represents all the worlds. And at the culmination of these 8 days, the sand is swept into a copper pot, and then it's thrown into the tippy top of a holy river in the Himalayas, basically the heavens, to be dispersed into the world, the prayers of these dedicated monks. And the string, the Rinpoche Tsokni in particular, takes this string, and Buddhists come from near and far outside of the temple to receive a little piece of this string around their wrist. And I was one of those. And in my understanding, the prayers of these 8 days are imbued in this string. And as each of us receives our little bit, we then travel in our ways about the world. And eventually, in my understanding, anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months, although I have heard tell 1 year, this string will fall off. And wherever you are, these prayers are then dispersed. So you are the vehicle for these prayers on your wrist in the form of this string. So shortly after Nepal, I moved out to Portland, and I was looking after my friend and was part of his care team as he was dying of ALS. And I thought, certainly, the string is going to come off here. These blessings and these prayers really need to come off here to help relieve the suffering of the family here. And it didn't. And And then a few years later, something happened. You might be familiar with it. It's a global pandemic. Maybe you're aware of that. And I thought this bracelet could literally come off anywhere and would be helping to relieve the suffering in the world, wherever I happen to be. But it didn't come off then. So we're talking years later now. And in October of 2021, I went to Egypt. I was diving in the Red Sea, and I thought, certainly this bracelet is going to fall off here in the Red Sea. The rising temperatures of seawater is just wreaking havoc on coral reefs around the world. I got COVID there. I was quarantined for an extra 14 days in Egypt. It was pretty stressful and scary, and I thought, maybe the string will come off there. But no, I returned home with the string on my wrist. This October 2023, I traveled to the Maldives and Sri Lanka again to dive. And the Maldives are really under threat of rising sea levels due to climate change. It's a very threatened nation. Also, the coral reefs there are under great duress and stress, and the pelagic species like the manta rays and whale sharks are also in diminishing and under duress. And I thought, absolutely, in 27 dives where you're pulling the wetsuit on and off all day long, this little threadbare, little tiny thing is definitely going to fall off. And on one day when I did a dive and we descended directly down to 78 feet and my tank exploded, I heard this enormous and I went to take a breath and there was no air. And I looked over and I saw my buddy right there. I swam over and I grabbed her alternate air source and put it in my mouth. We secured contact. We slowly, safely ascended. I lived to tell the tale. It was still there. I couldn't believe it. And Sri Lanka, same, didn't come off. And I arrived home after this trip thinking, what in the world? How is this even still on my wrist? This is incredible. A week later, I was preparing for the first of two weekends of offering a yoga training program that I've created and cultivated and curated. And I had a lovely group of people I was really prepared and like getting ready for this training with. And I feel like this is my dharma. This is my work in the world. And I was really excited for this. I was getting ready the afternoon of, and I looked and the bracelet was gone. It was just gone. I had seen it the day before. And in this unceremonious disappearance, I had conflicting feelings. At first I felt incredible grief. Like this had been with me for 5 years and had traveled with me through so many things. And I was always noticing it and always touching it, and it was always there. Alternately, I also felt great relief, like, oh, it's off. I don't have to keep wondering when is it going to come off and where. But I didn't know where or how it had fallen off my wrist. And I realized in this moment that in reality, the bracelet, not only had it been protecting me, through all these events of my life, but that it wasn't the bracelet. It's not the bracelet that carries the prayers, that carries the blessings. It's those of us, I feel so moved, it's those of us who sat and received and witnessed the effort of these monks and their deep dedication to relieving the suffering of the world. It's us who carry these blessings. It's the person, the heart in us. And these blessings are in me and with me, and it's my responsibility to be a part of that. So, may you be happy, and may you be free. May all beings be happy, and may all beings be free. And may my thoughts and words and deeds in some way contribute to your happiness and your freedom. Thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. So we have a first-timer, Aristotle Taylor, here today, who's going to be our second storyteller. Aristotle, are you in the audience? Oh, hello. Welcome.
Gonna be honest, I will take any excuse I can to talk about my trip to Ireland. So that's what this is. But anyways, I was so privileged earlier this summer to go on a trip to Ireland to complete not one, but two different internships within the field of public history. My first internship took a couple of weeks, and it was at the Irish Labor Historical Society, identified as cataloging and documenting stuff from the office of Michael D. Higgins, who is the president of Ireland. And then the next internship I completed was at 14 Henrietta, which is a tenement museum kind of in the heart of Dublin, a little bit off of O'Connell Street. But I'm not here to talk about that. I'm going to talk to you guys about the absolute highlight of this trip, okay? So when you get a bunch of history nerds to go to a foreign country together, they're going to want to go to the museums there. And I was looking forward to one museum in particular, Dublin's National Archaeological Museum. So picture this. It's a Saturday. We had just gotten out of the Oscar Wilde house, another fantastic place to visit. Love that fruity little man. We had just gotten a recommendation from another traveler about a great tattoo shop, which we ended up getting tattoos from. And then we went to the archaeological museum, and there was one thing that I was looking forward to, the bog bodies. So I went in there knowing that they were there, but not where they were. So immediately upon entering, I am overwhelmed. There is a lot of stuff there. There is so much pottery, jewelry, weaponry, religious artifacts, everything you could think of, they had it. And it was so wonderful to just walk through all these perfectly preserved pieces of history. And something that I don't think a lot of people give the field of history credit for is just how much love is contained into it. We preserve these things because we want to say, look at us, we were here, we mattered, we loved, and we lost. So we enter a little exhibit called Kingship and Sacrifice, and inside this room are smaller little circle rooms that you don't really know what's in there until you go in. So I'm not paying attention to my surroundings. But as I'm looking over all of these religious artifacts, all of these cool-looking weapons, I happen to wander into one of these little spiral things, and I saw my first bog body. He is officially known as the Old Congan Man, named for the area in that he was found in. So the cool thing about bog bodies is that bogs are very acidic because of the peat in them. So what happens if you bury a body in there is it essentially gets pickled. So the Old Congan Man had these very perfectly preserved hands, and you wonder, did they ever hold someone else? Did they ever pick flowers? I remember walking by one of the bodies, and it had this bright ginger hair, and it was curly, and it looked just like my partner's hair. And I thought about braiding my partner's hair, and I wondered, did anyone ever braid this man's hair? Did anyone ever comb their fingers through it? Did anyone ever kiss the top of their head? Most of the bog bodies found were, of course, victims of the battle. So we don't know what battle they were fighting in. I mean, these bodies are dated from 400 to 200 before Common Era. So we don't know what they were fighting for, if it was land, power. We don't know who loved them, who mourned them, but we once did. And the thing about history and love is that it's not just the love that we used to have, it's the love that we still have. You see, there were 35 specialists that worked on the bog bodies alone to bring this exhibit to life for us to enjoy. 35 people said, your story mattered. We don't know who you are now, but we knew who you were then, and we love you. Thank you.
That was so sweet. Thank you, Aristotle. You're welcome to come back anytime and tell another story. We're going to move it right along to Melissa Cedars. Melissa's my neighbor, and she's an amazing chalk artist. She also is part of the Coldwater Dolphins, so which means that this badass human gets into the lake even in the dead of winter.
That's true. I just wanted to tell a story about when the scientist becomes the lab rat. So a little background. I've been in the medical field for nearly 20 years now. I worked in hospitals and clinics as a clinical laboratory scientist, and I'm not even going to ask if anyone knows what that is. Let me just say that the doctors and nurses do not test your blood, urine, stool, whatever you give at the, whatever you give them to test. But recently I took a job at the UMD Medical School as a researcher. So my career has kind of gone full circle. As an undergrad, I did research with rats. And at that time, I did spend 2 months doing kind of pap smears on rats every morning for 2 months. and going, if you can imagine them in their little stirrups and the little speculum, and just... But, well, not really, just a little pipette, you squish a little saline and put it on a slide and look at the slide. So for 2 months, every morning I was looking at cells from the rat's vagina. And now I don't do that anymore, but I still do work with rats and mice. sometimes I do offer myself up as the proverbial lab rat, though. It's necessary in the medical field. That's how everyone learns and grows. Somebody has to be the first person you've ever poked with a needle. So sometimes in the medical school, we get emails or we see posters when they're looking for standardized patients, especially for the medical students. So I've done the carotid artery ultrasounds for the med students. I've been a standardized patient for their history and physical interviews, where they're learning that patient, doctor, talking back and forth, getting comfortable, asking personal questions. And last December, I got an email from the med school office, because I am on a list now. And this one, they were St. Scholastica was looking for sensitive exam patients. At the bottom of the email, it said, pay rate, $150 an hour. Great. Great. I was getting ready to go to Hawaii. I could use an extra $300 for 2 hours of work. So the brochure attached to the email, have you ever wondered how your doctor, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant learn how to perform a breast and pelvic exam? I guess I hadn't thought of it, really. I mean, I know they learn that in school, but... And how do they learn to help women feel comfortable during these personal exams? Does anyone feel comfortable during them? But okay, I'll put myself out there. I'll make the money. They ask for feedback. I'll give my feedback. So I signed up. This was my chance to become that little rat, to buy a chance to become uncomfortable. And so fast forward to May. This email had come out in December. There was some time delays, weather delays, students driving up from the Twin Cities. So the first week of May, I remember it being very hot. But it's the first week of May in Duluth, so I'm guessing it wasn't. But the morning of this experience, some ladies landscape a little hand. I don't really care. They see what they're going to see. Take a shower, put on a little extra deodorant. Those breast exams, they get all up in your armpits. But I grab the disposable wipes from the back of the toilet, tuck them in my backpack for later, because I have to go to work for the morning. So I'm at work, and I'm getting a little nervous. Christine, you can, wherever you are, you can verify this. I was getting a little nervous. In my mind, it's hot. Yeah, I'm sweating profusely. My coworkers were very aware of why I was taking the afternoon off. and then it was time. I drive half mile to St. Scholastica. I'm not so familiar with that campus, but I was trying to find the place. I parked, went in the buildings, decided to use the bathroom that one last time that we all kind of do before that exam. Get that last bit of urine out, a little more deodorant, freshen up a bit. I found the room and I met the instructor, and she puts me in the exam room. Looks like any other exam room from any doctor's office. The table that you have to hop up on, she gives me the gown. I fold up my clothes in a nice neat pile. Some of you might be crumplers, but I want it to be neat. I want them to think I'm a neat person. And then the instructor and the three students come in. That's right, three. I had signed up for not one breast and pelvic exam, but four. So I'm not sure who was more uncomfortable, me definitely feeling walking in. Now they were all, I was definitely feeling like a lab rat about to be experimented on, and I was. These were all female presenting students, so had presumably been through this themselves. So, okay. The first problem I had, I was sweating. They had that stupid flimsy paper on the table. I was stuck. So I had to stop the train and say, I'm sorry, you guys, but I'm kind of stuck to the paper. And then the instructor very graciously is like, oh, I forgot to put down the absorbent pad. That's supposed to be there. Okay, so I get up and pick the stuff out and get situated again and drop the front of the gown to start the breast exam. And I'm exposed. I'm not used to being exposed in front of four people at a time. Some of you are, that's fine, I'm not. So she did her breast exam to teach them how to the right way to do the circles and use the right amount of pressure. That wasn't so bad. Then it came time for the pelvic exam. Okay, put your feet in the stirrups. Scooch down, and I swear they teach that word. They teach how to use that word, scooch down a little more. And I made the mistake at one point of looking down, and there were four heads down there in my bits. Some of you who've had babies might be used to that, or no, I'm not. And she was giving useful hints and tips on how to do everything. Always ask for them to run the speculum under warm water first. It's nice. And at one point, I was offered a mirror to check things out from their point of view. Never had that offer before, so why not? Done in every pelvic exam. Tosses the swab into the garbage. And then that's finished. Okay, the first one's done. Then the first student comes up, and she does her breast exam a little more tender, not as much pressure. She's trying to learn how to get everything right. And then it's time for the second pelvic exam. Right, been through this, fine, do what you're gonna do, learn something. Somebody threw their gloves in the trash, and then all of a sudden something landed on my face. I screamed. The four of them in the room just stood there in horror. And I'm like, what the fuck just fell on my face? Is this a spider? I don't know. I pick it up, it's the swab from the first exam. I threw it back in the garbage and said, you know, at least it was mine. So I'm trying to comfort them a bit so they can get on. Let's get this going. Let's get this over with. So the rest of it was uneventful for the most part. There were a few ill-placed pinches, some readjusting, wrong angles. It was a learning experience for all involved. And then I had an incident where I kind of had a concussion later that week, and I'd kind of forgotten a few things, and I got an envelope in the mail, no return address. And I pull out, and I know you can't see this very well, but it's a sticker with Jesus peeking around the corner. It says, "I saw that." And there's a Q-tip taped to it. And I was just standing there like, what is this? I don't get it. And then my wife looks over at me. She goes, "Really? You don't get it? Melissa, remember the swab, the pap smears?" I thought, oh, geez. That was my good friend Stacy sending me what things we always send each other in the mail just to remind me of that experience. So that, my friends, is how the scientist became a lab rat.
Oh, you nailed it, Melissa. You nailed it.
Thanks for warming everybody up. Getting us a little looser. My story's about Jesus, too. But not with a Q-tip. So I'm Cynthia, and I grew up in the small town of Solon Springs, Wisconsin. Anybody know it? And lived in the same house my entire life. Small town, everybody knows you. Everybody knows your business. Everybody knows you, and everybody knows your business. So if you're good, it's good. And if, you know, you messed up, everybody knows. There we go. I have to start my timer. Adeline said 10 minutes. So grew up in the small town. I'm the oldest child in my household. And when I was four, and I don't remember this, but my mom tells me this. When I was four, my mom started going to this little church in Savings. And how she says it is she met Jesus, and Jesus saved her life. And so she comes home, and I'm 4 years old, and she says to me, "Cynthia, I met Jesus, and I want you to meet Jesus too." And she says, I said, "Okay, all right." She said, you just have to pray and ask Jesus to come into your heart, and you're good." I said, "Okay." She said, "So can I pray with you?" And I said, "Nope." I'm four. I said, "Nope, I'll do it myself." So I did, and I guess Jesus came on in. Jesus has never left, even though I've tried to push him out. Jesus is still there. So I grow up loving Jesus, loving this church. I am full line and sinker in this church, right? It's conservative, evangelical, hands raising, speaking in tongues kind of church. And I love it. And my one mission in life is to save souls for Jesus so you don't go to hell. That's my job. Tell everybody about Jesus, save your soul. And I remember one time when I was in high school, I'm on my hands and knees in my bedroom, and I'm praying to God saying, "I want to be a missionary. Send me anywhere, to Africa, India, Antarctica. I'll go wherever. But God, just don't send me to the homosexuals." Now, I didn't even know what a homosexual was, but I had heard it was real bad from my little church. Homosexual, real bad. So I prayed, "God, don't send me there." And God was thinking, "Okay, fine, I won't send you to the homosexuals. I'll make you one." God. So I go to college, the big town of UW-Superior. I remember my mom saying, "Be careful. They teach tolerance there." So I was careful. I signed up to go to on a mission trip. I always wanted to, right? I'm still that little girl who wants to be a missionary. So I sign up to go on this trip to Malta, little island in the Mediterranean Sea. It's 2 months, and our mission is to go tell the people about Jesus, save their souls, because they have it wrong. And so we got to tell them about Jesus, save their souls, and we're going to do it through music and puppet shows. You know, I've never thought that was funny, but it really is. Okay. So I'm there, and I don't think we saved any souls. But here's what happened to me on this mission trip. I got drunk for the first time. I kissed a girl for the first time. And here's the serious part. On the plane ride home, I'm just, well, dead tired for one and thinking, oh my God, I got drunk and I kissed a girl. I'm going to hell. But I'm also thinking, we were supposed to bring Jesus to the people because they didn't know Jesus, and they're going to all go to hell. And what I experienced and what I learned from these people is that God, Spirit, Jesus, energy, Allah, Buddha, whatever, is already there. And they don't need me coming in and telling them they're wrong and what to believe and how to believe it. So I learned that. I never said it out loud because I knew that would be real bad. So I get back, and dealing with the drunkenness and the girl kissing. And a couple years of hard time. So, you know, I had surrounded myself with people just like me who believed exactly like me. And I knew those people would not like what I had done or what I was thinking. So it was lots of hard years, and me trying to figure things out, my own self-rejection. Remember, homosexuals, real bad? And I wanted to keep kissing girls. I really liked thinking about that. And I met a girl and kissed her again. Different girl, and I knew I had to come out. I knew I had to tell my family, Solon Springs, Superior, not too far. And they were going to hear about this, and I didn't want them to hear from the grapevine. They needed to hear from me because it was going to be a blow no matter what. So I took my sister, bless her. I took her with me. I already told her. She was like, ooh. I love you, but okay, do you really want me to be there? Yes. So I'm there with my mom and dad, and I say, and I shouldn't have said I think. I should have just said, Mom and Dad, I'm gay, or I'm a lesbian, or I'm queer, or whatever. But what I said was, I think I'm gay. And my dad just kind of did that, and my mom said, oh, no, no, you're not, honey. I have a book for you. She did. So she already suspected it or something. I don't know. And so it was bad. My family, my church, my friends that I had surrounded myself with all rejected me when they found out. And I had a lot of conversations with God, Jesus, whoever, saying, what the heck? So I don't think I can really be a missionary anymore because people are telling me you can't be queer and love God and follow God at the same time. They're incompatible. So, okay, I got to think of something else. So I went into teaching, and I taught music and art for about 5 years. But I had that nagging something or other in my heart. Well, like I said, Jesus got in there and never left. I knew that I wasn't going to be let go by this the spirit that had me since I was four. So I went to seminary. According to my mom, not a real school, but I went. And it changed my life. And I met so many wonderful, smart people who thought about God and religion. You can actually think. You don't just have to believe things and you can think. And there's not answers for everything. And what I learned was that the most important thing is to love, and you don't have to judge. Isn't that cool? Yes. You don't have to judge. You don't. All you have to do is be kind and love people, no matter what. You don't have to agree with all the things they think or do or say. You just gotta love. And so I became a pastor. And with that, I experienced a lot of rejection, also a lot of encouragement. And I'll just end with one little story that I feel like is maybe one of the greatest blessings that I've experienced in being in ministry and being a queer pastor. I was appointed to a little church here in Duluth. I won't mention any names. If you know me at all, you'll know which one. But I was appointed to this little church, and the bishop who appointed me said, "Now, Cynthia, you cannot come out. You cannot come out and tell them that you are queer. You can't. If they find out, fine, but you cannot say it." And the bishop doesn't live in Duluth, and I said, "But I have children, and I have a beautiful wife." Sorry, Adeline. I'll wrap it up in 2 minutes. I have a wife, and I have kids. People know who I am. I can't be in the closet. I can't. I tried that, and it almost killed me. I can't. And said, "I'm sorry, you cannot come out. If you come out and say that you're queer at this meet and greet thing, I could lose my job as a bishop because I'm not allowed to appoint gay people. But I love you." And so I thought about that and thought about that, and it was wrong, but I decided, okay, I won't say it. So at this meet and greet, we had a lovely time, lovely time, lovely people. Oh, yes, they loved me. They were excited to have me be their pastor. And then at the end, I said, "Would you like to see a picture of my family?" Yes! So on my phone, I had a picture, and they passed it around. Hey, everybody smiles. It gets back to me, and then that was that. So I never said it. I followed the directions, but I still came out. And so I was the pastor at this little church for 5 years, and probably about year three, several people left the church because they couldn't fathom having a queer pastor. But other people joined, so it evened out. Maybe around year three, this older lady who I adore basically runs this. So she said, "Cynthia, I want to tell you something. So knowing you has changed me. My granddaughter called me the other day and said, 'Grandma, I'm gonna come and visit you.' And she said, 'Yay, I'm so excited.' And then she said, 'And I want to bring my girlfriend with me. Is that okay?' And the older lady said, 'Absolutely. I would love to meet her. Bring her. I'm excited.' And that was their conversation. And she said, 'Cynthia, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been able to say that. Knowing you, knowing your family, has changed my idea and my heart about the LGBT community, and I thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for sticking with us, because I never knew a gay person before you. Obviously, she probably did, just didn't know it. But that right there is my mission as a minister, is to love and be who I am, because just being who you are changes people. That goes for everybody. Even if you're straight, it's okay. I'm done, Adeline.